from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, how natural disasters exacerbate inequities. After the deadly fires in Sonoma County in 2017, community leaders called out rampant disparities in how low-income and immigrant communities experienced and recovered from the fires. Failures in emergency communication, price gouging, and lack of access to aid mirror what experts say is a national trend when natural disasters strike. We look at the impact of fires, evacuations, power shutoffs on those just getting by, and how to do disaster recovery equitably. Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, sitting in today for Michael Krasny. The Kincade Fire is yet another example of how California and the U.S. are experiencing more extreme and unprecedented weather events and natural disasters. A growing body of research finds that these events and their recovery efforts are exacerbating economic inequality, which then gets compounded by each subsequent disaster. To take a deeper look at this cycle, we'll be joined by fire survivors, community advocates, and experts. And we're joined first by Thomas Fuller. He's San Francisco Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Good morning, Thomas Fuller.
Good morning.
And to be clear, these catastrophic wildfires, they do not discriminate between the rich and poor. Mobile home parks, mansions, they've all gone up in flames at the mercy of the winds in our natural disasters, these wildfires that we've had in the last few years. But how these groups experience and recover from these events is, these are things that are vastly different. And I'm wondering if you could highlight a couple of stories from your New York Times piece that really illustrate this.
Sure. You know, I think you're right. We see natural disasters as kind of a great equalizer. I mean, 2 years ago, we had, you know, the Journey's End trailer park destroyed. And then just up the road in Fountain Grove, we had, you know, these big mansions destroyed by the same fire. I think what's interesting is when you look 2 years later at what has happened, you see divergent paths in people's recovery process. You see, for instance, we talked to someone who was on the outskirts of Santa Rosa who managed to get enough insurance money to rebuild a home that he called his dream home. It was really he pointed it in a different direction to have a nicer view. He had 16-foot windows in the room, whereas before he had smaller windows. He had, you know, well, he just modernized it, you know, in sort of the way you'd think of an Architectural Digest, home. And he was able to do that with money from his insurance payout. And then on the other hand, you have people in Paradise who we spoke to whose lives just unraveled with this. I mean, they some of them had to leave the state. They were living in cabins or small homes that were destroyed, that were uninsured. Their relationships fell apart. They were living precariously before the fire, and then afterwards are now really right on the edge of homelessness, if I can say. And some people did become homeless as well. So I think there's that idea that, you know, where what your standing is before the fire obviously affects how you're going to live the experience. But even more interesting than that, I thought, was, you know, it goes without saying that if you're better off, you're going to weather it better, I think. But it disproportionately hurts people of lower means, these disasters. I think that's interesting. In other words, they their credit scores, for instance. There are studies that show that credit scores actually lower are down 30 points as compared to someone who is better off to begin with, and it's down 8 points. That's just one measure, but that's what I found interesting.
Yes, I think you're referencing the Urban Institute study that I also read that talked about just a larger proportion of people who are low income and even some middle income families, that they are much more likely to have their debt in collections, to be bankrupt, to be delinquent on their mortgages much later down the line.
Yeah, I think access to capital is very important, and it's also navigating the whole insurance world. It takes a lot of kind of lawyerly analysis to understand the process. You often have to sue to recover the amount that you think you're owed. That's been very common, and you have to have the wherewithal and the time to do this. You need to have some savings to fall back on so you can carry out this recovery process. And of course, people who are, living paycheck to paycheck don't have the time or the savings. So it's, it's punishing for them. I mean, the one statistic that sticks out to me that I think just speaks to the larger sort of inequalities that underlie all these points is, if you own a home in America, then, and this is the U.S. in general, but I think it's applicable to us here. If you own a home, you have a net worth of around $200,000 on average. Obviously, in California, that would be a lot more. If you're renting, you have a net worth of about $5,000. That's a huge disparity. And if you confronting a natural disaster like these fires, it's really going to be different for the owners and the renters. That's one dichotomy. And then there are the well-insured versus the woefully underinsured.
Yes, and in that way, you seem to be getting at preparedness too, like who does have the insurance, and then even just if you are somebody who's just getting by, your ability to afford disaster preparedness items from lanterns or flashlights, those kinds of things can even be cost prohibitive. To create an emergency kit with water reserves and canned food, that can also be hard to put together, to cobble together.
Yeah, absolutely. It's both before the disaster and after the disaster that we see these disparities. I was particularly struck by differences in counties like Lake County, just north of Napa. 2,000 homes were destroyed there over the last 4 years or so. Two-thirds of that county has burned over the last 4 years. I mean, it's really been traumatic, and a lot of people were either underinsured or just didn't have insurance. They were retirees who had paid off their homes, and because insurance is expensive, especially in vulnerable areas, we've seen these rates go up. To compare the trajectory, the path that some of these people in Lake County have gone through with, for instance, wealthier counties to the south, Napa or Sonoma, I think is a really sort of instructive analysis as well.
Well, we're joined now by Irma Garcia. She's a volunteer at the Immigrant Defense Task Force in Sonoma County. Good morning, Irma Garcia.
Buenos dias. Thank you for letting me to be here.
Well, we really appreciate you being here. And I know, Irma Garcia, that you have done a lot since the 2017 wildfires to try to help immigrant communities, also non-English speakers or mainly Spanish speakers, try to deal with the disaster as it's unfolding. And I wanted to ask you if some of the recommendations that you made in 2017 were actually implemented this time around. For example, were you able to receive, or were people in the community that you were talking to able to receive alerts in Spanish?
Yes, we received in two languages, but sometimes, most of the time in English.
Most of the time in English. When you were at local assistance centers and shelters, were you able to speak with people who could speak Spanish? Were you able to were they clearly identified as you requested that they be? And were they respectful to the community? Because that was also something that really affected you last time.
Yes. So the last time we didn't have any information in Spanish and any people who was bilingual. And even though we have a lot of nonprofit organizations that speak Spanish, they were not involved. They were not included, even though they want to. But because the Red Cross was the only head to organize that, it was a very, very hard well that they put in there. So nobody could be volunteer, and I have a very bad experience with the Red Cross the last year when I was evacuated, and I went with my family, and I was able to help because my parents always teaching me, if you need food, you have to work for it. So I went to be volunteer with my son. He was 14, my girl who was 5, and my husband. And we were working since 3 a.m. until 5 p.m., and the lady from the Red Cross came and say, ordered me to take all the beds out. And I said, yeah, but I can't. I have to take in my girl. My husband and my son is doing it. And later she say, I say now. And I say, I'm sorry, I can't. My priority is my girl. And he say, I say now. And my girl was in the bed resting from 2 a.m. to 5 p.m. And she say, get out of the bed. And he say, stop. Don't talk to my daughter like that. She's 5 years old. She's amazing. She's helping so much. And she didn't care. And she say, get out of the bed. And because she didn't, she said, get out of here. So we have a very terrible experience with the Red Cross, and nobody was speaking Spanish, and nobody was make us welcome. So we had to leave the shelter and go spending the night in the car. But later a friend called us, and she brought us to her house. So this situation was so scary for me. Not because for me, because I know how to survive, but you can imagine how it was happening with the people who lost everything and they don't speak English and they are there and they treat them like that. How the kids example they will be if they are citizens. So they nobody respects citizens at all. My children are citizens, but because I am undocumented, so it doesn't matter. They don't respect them too. This time is very much better. Because the Corazon Hillsport was involved in the veterans building. So they gave us welcome to a lot of community. And because they, in the veterans building, in Corazon Hillsport, that building was evacuated. So they moved to veterans building. So that's another story. So the Red Cross is doing their job, but not only by their power, it's under other organizations. And that's make a lot of difference. I went there because I brought an indigenous family who has 4 kids. She doesn't speak English, and Spanish is her second language, and she's not speaking like I'm not speaking English, you know, because it's my second language. So she really was needing help, and when I came there, Corazon Hugo was helping, and the Red Cross lady who was in front was volunteering, and she was speaking Spanish. She was amazing. So I had a very good experience this time, but because the organization were involved.
Yes, and before I let you go, so what are the things that you are worried about in terms of the recovery from this wildfire? What are you hearing from the people who have reached out to the Immigrant Defense Task Force about some of the biggest consequences of either the fire or these power shutoffs and evacuations?
Thank you for asking that question. And we are working for two years, educating people that immigrant and undocumented community are paying taxes. And they are not, the system is not excluding them from taxes. And we have obligation from the government to report how much we make from the whole year. If we are not doing, we're in trouble. So, but the question is, who will, it's millions of dollars, but who is taking the money? Because we will never retire. So we will not receive any penny back. Because this is the system is only for citizens, so we are excluded for that. But not that we are included to pay taxes. So my question and what I'm really to begging, because I don't know what can I do, is understanding that immigrant and undocumented community don't receive any help from the city, from the county, and from the state. So how they can survive, how they can be prepared for the next disaster, if they 2 years ago, we are still not recuperated for that.
Yes.
And now, again. So what is my point is, I want to every people who can have ears and heart thinking about immigrant and undocumented community and help us to go to the supervisors or the city council and to change the law. And because it's a natural disaster, everybody needs to be included and everybody needs to be treated the same and everybody needs to have the same help.
Well, Irma, thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us and your concerns. It's a question that I actually want to put to our next guests who will be joining us on the show as well. Irma Garcia, she's a volunteer for the Immigrant Defense Task Force, part of the North Bay Organizing Project in Sonoma County. Good to talk to you.
Gracias.
And we're joined now by Jim Elliott. He is a professor and chair of sociology at Rice University. He's the author of Sights Unseen, Uncovering Hidden Hazards in American Cities. Welcome to Forum, Jim Elliott.
Hi, Mina. Thank you.
I don't know if you had a chance to hear Irma Garcia there, but really what she's underscoring is a problem that's also been laid out across the U.S. in post-disaster, which is that people's ability to access aid, whether it be at the local, state, or federal level, is significantly hampered by their economic situation or their immigration status.
That's right. I think Thomas and Irma have made some incredibly important points and offered some poignant stories. And so what I've done as a researcher with a colleague at Junia Howe at University of Pittsburgh is we wanted to go out and see if these stories that we're hearing from Thomas and Irma about the fires in Santa Rosa either 2 years ago or more recently or now are generalizable. Is this not just a California problem, but is it actually an American problem with respect to how we recover from these types of disasters? And so what we did is we went out and assembled a bunch of data on longitudinal surveys that we could follow people through time for 10 or 15 years as natural disasters hit where they lived. And we came away with three important findings, we think. The first one is that Irma's right. Statistically, when you look across the country, not just at wildfires, but the whole slew of natural hazards, whether it be flooding or tornadoes and this sort of thing, the more damage a place experiences from those types of damages, the worse it is for lower-income people and people of color. So we're able to show that statistically, that it makes their housing security decrease. They're more mobile. They have to look for housing and move around and change communities. But equally, if not more importantly, their wealth also declines. As they're taking stock and trying to recover from these things, they actually do a lot worse. And we weren't terribly surprised by that, given the stories that we had heard. But when we looked at the other groups, what we found is that Thomas is right, too, that on average, the more natural hazard damage there is in a place, a given county, the better off white and better educated, and particularly if they're homeowners, do. Their wealth actually goes up. They benefit from this over time. And this is not discounting the trauma that might be there and is certainly very real, but over time, over the next 5-10 years, they actually benefit.
Wait a second. If I could just stop you for a second.
Yep.
You're saying that after a disaster, that white wealthier communities are in an even better position than they were before it?
That's what the data show. And it's not communities. It's individuals. We did it at a family level. So it's households. And that's controlling for the amount of insurance payments they put in, controlling for the quality of their neighborhood. And
but you were able
factors.
To see patterns based on race, it sounds like.
Race, and they get compounded. So it's not just race. It's also home ownership versus renter status, mm-hmm. education. So when you get groups like Irma was talking about where they experience a number of these sort of disadvantages or deficits in social resources, they compound. And the other thing that we found, the third finding, is the more FEMA money comes in to help with recovery, the worse those inequalities get. It doesn't help the problem.
So FEMA actually exacerbates this.
We don't know how because the data aren't transparent, but when we just take their basic publicly available data on how much they're putting into long-term recovery through basic public infrastructure investments and recovery investments, that correlates. The more there is of that coming in controlling for the amount of damage, the more these inequalities that Thomas and Irma are talking about actually manifest or become bigger.
Are you referencing an NPR analysis? I know that they looked at FEMA data and found that white communities were more likely to get buyouts and other kinds of economic support from FEMA.
Right. So we've talked to Rebecca Hersher at National NPR, and the story that they did on that drew from some of our other research as well as the research I'm talking to you about. So there is that aspect as well. It's not just FEMA buyouts that are doing this, but that's another part of the issue, that only homeowners are able to get this kind of assistance from the federal government to relocate them from a flood-prone or and fire-prone area, for instance. And in this case, it's just flooding. That's how the program is set up. And so what happens is homeowners are already in a position to benefit from that type of aid where renters are not. And so that actually plays out into how different neighborhoods use those buyouts. And what we found when we look around Houston in case of flooding is that the better off neighborhoods where there's a buyout, it actually enhances property values. That space becomes demolished and it's a pocket park that the city has to maintain the grass and kids can go play there. Unless advantaged communities, underserved communities, oftentimes there are a lot of different lots that get bought out and they become a place where illegal dumping occurs and it becomes a disamenity.
And do I understand correctly that you are planning to present this evidence to a House subcommittee soon?
Right. So based on some of the research that Junia Howell and I have done, there was an inquiry put forward by or to the Government Accountability Office, which is the research wing of the U.S. Congress, to look at these basic questions. And what they pointed out is when they looked at our research, they said, I think two things. One is that we haven't really paid a lot of attention to these inequalities in recovery. So that's good. They're saying now we have to look into that. And then number two, we need to look across the suite of different programs, because as Thomas and Irma mentioned, there are so many different programs, it's hard to know what's actually happening with the money and where it's going. So they're trying to begin to at least acknowledge that they need to do a little bit more of that accounting.
We're talking with Jim Elliott. He's professor and chair of sociology at Rice University and the author of Sights Unseen, Uncovering Hidden Hazards in American Cities. Thomas Fuller is San Francisco bureau chief for The New York Times. And we talked with Irma Garcia, a volunteer for the Immigrant Defense Task Force, who works with the North Bay Organizing Project in Sonoma County. And I'd like to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. We're looking at how inequities are exacerbated by wildfires and other natural disasters. And what can be done to try to do disaster recovery more equitably? We'll get into that more after the break. If you'd like to join us with your experiences based on what you're hearing from Thomas and Irma, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on Facebook, Twitter. You can tweet us at KQED Forum on Facebook or email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Mina Kim. We'll have more after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're looking at how natural disasters, unprecedented weather events are exacerbating income inequality, not just when the event is occurring and the destruction that it causes, but also the recovery efforts and some of the strategies that are being implemented. Then the cycle deepens and continues. We're talking with Jim Elliott. He's a professor and chair of sociology at Rice University. We're also joined by Thomas Fuller, San Francisco bureau chief for The New York Times, who recently spoke with fire survivors 1 to 2 years out to see how they were doing. And we're joined now by Gabriela Orantes. She is a Just Recovery Fellow with the North Bay Organizing Project. Welcome, Gabriela Orantes.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. I was wondering if you could give us a sense of how you, I know, have been talking with evacuees and those who were dealing with power outages and how the communities that you've been talking to have been affected.
Sure, yes. Through a collaboration of organizations led by the efforts of Corazon Healdsburg, we have placed ourselves in shelters throughout the past week to address the concerns and offer bilingual support to immigrant families, Spanish-speaking families at the shelter. And what we've seen is a lot of families who have thankfully now been able to return home, but really concerned about the fact that they haven't been able to work and had to flee, and now concerned of what will be their economic situation, considering rent is coming up and how they'll be able to access resources to assist them financially. And that's just one component, but financially in this situation.
So, yes, November 1st is tomorrow. Rent is due for a lot of folks. And so one of the big concerns is they're not going to be compensated for this lost time.
Potentially not. I mean, that is something that there are employers that are understanding, others that that's not a component of their system of compensation. And so navigating programs or assistance, any kind of assistance out there, public assistance, navigating those opportunities is not something that is available to all. And so there's definitely concern of how folks will be able to make ends meet.
Well, I'd like to invite our listeners again to the conversation, 866-733-6786, the number to call, 866-733-6786. And I'd like to go to Ramona. She is in Lake County. Hi, Ramona.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having this conversation. And I also want to thank one of your speakers for bringing Lake County specifically into the conversation. We were not directly impacted by the fires that are going on in Santa Rosa right now, but we were impacted by this latest round of PSPS shutoffs. And I just got my power back yesterday after being, you know, having no power for 5 days. Mm. I have a solar powered generator. I could get on the internet. I could run my computer. I could make a cup of coffee. But I have, you know, there's people in the community that are just so low income. They're not working because the businesses are closed. The businesses are losing hundreds of thousands of dollars of inventory. People can't pay the rent, just as was mentioned earlier. And what I'm most concerned about is that we are often overlooked. We're surrounded by two of the wealthiest communities in California, Napa and Sonoma. And we often get skipped right over to have news about Mendocino when we're suffering from the same impacts in a much lower income community. So just as your speaker was saying, the impacts of this are compounded year over year over year now that businesses close, they're shuttered. Nobody's going to come open a business here if they think that their electricity is going to get turned off every other week. Who can come and buy a home here knowing that the grid's not responsible or that wire fires abatement has been left unchecked for years and years? The things that are affecting Lake County are just exacerbated by these PSPSs. I'm really emotional about this right now because I see the people in my community that are really, really hurting. And to know that this is going to further compound the problems within our community, it's just heartbreaking. And I would love for people to know that Lake County is a really beautiful place. We're wine country. We're not Napa, so we're affordable if you want to come up here and do a wine tasting. But I encourage you to come visit our community and come and see that it is really beautiful and that it is worth coming to visit and spending your money here and helping our community come back from this.
Well, Ramona, thanks for that. And Thomas Fuller, any reaction to what you're hearing Ramona say?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it is. I think, you know, the power shutoffs are really another aspect of this that are really important. I mean, we had the power shut off in the East Bay where I live, but I went out and bought a $1,000 generator, and I had, you know, was able to have power for the 4 days that it was out this past week. I have a job where I'm not paid by the hour, you know, so I was able to. Well, I mean, my job is to cover this situation, but you know, it really is. The power shutoffs have really divided our neighborhoods into those who are inconvenienced and those, you know, for whom it's a financial debacle or, you know, it's a real setback.
Yes, and you're talking about businesses, too, that experience closures as a result of this. Those are also, besides their losses, their economic losses, you're talking about the people who work for these entities who may or may not get that any compensation for their inability to work because those businesses were closed. I mean, Gabriela Orantes, that sounds like what you heard quite a bit among the people that you spoke with.
Absolutely. So, yes, and a lot of folks I want to mention that we are working with predominantly Latino communities through our Just Recovery Partnership. And being that many of those that were evacuated initially came from Geyserville, Healdsburg, and Windsor, we encountered many, many farm workers, vineyard workers who were concerned if they had a job to go back to. Some who live on there, who have farm worker housing, were dropped off by some of their companies at the shelters, from left to fend for themselves. And then still today, I need to follow up with a couple who weren't sure if they had a place to go back to because they hadn't heard from their employer. So 71, according to our records, our data from 2017, when we first started our Just Recovery Partnership, 71% of vineyard and agricultural workforce in our region is Latino. And being that many of those first evacuated were from the vineyard and agricultural industry, this was, I mean, this is the story. These were the stories that we heard. A lot of concern of if they would have work to go back to and what to do without a week's worth of pay.
And in the midst of it all, I mean, there were people who were also desperately trying to bring in the harvest so that the grapes wouldn't be damaged by smoke. And so it's this crazy choice between almost your health or, you know, your finances.
And that's a really important reality. In Cloverdale, we got wind a couple days ago that there were about 400 people out there staying in their cars because there wasn't a shelter open. And when we offered, and there was no power, and when we offered to bring Corazon Healdsburg was leading the effort and offering folks a way to get to the shelters in southern Sonoma County, folks had said they didn't want to because they were wanting to be there in case there was going to be work. Mm-hmm. So this is an example of people choosing to stay in a place where it's freezing temperatures at night, can't go back to their homes because of the power shutoff, and they were choosing to stay because of the possibility of work, but that's the dire situation that our communities are in.
Well, this listener writes, the American Indian Film Festival, celebrating its 44th year, has had to cancel its final night because of the fires. This organization is a family-run labor of love and a rich part of San Francisco's cultural traditions, and this year they will lose money. Communities of color don't just suffer personal loss. Their cultural events are also disproportionately impacted because they have no recourse to recover lost revenue. Let me go to Liza in Guerneville. Hi, Liza.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Go ahead.
Okay, I have been working as a volunteer on long-term recovery since the wildfires in 2017. And I have, I think, I have got 4 points I'd like to make. The first one is that I really want to commend the first responders who have done a fantastic job, and also the people in the agencies and the government offices who are working on long-term recovery. They are trying really hard and deserve our thanks. And I want to say some negative things, but I want to say that positive thing first. We had no idea how to respond to the fires 2 years ago, and we're learning a huge amount. That said, we still need to address a lot of problems. I think one of the major problems has to do with the FEMA and the national coming down mandate to the local organizations who are really stuck solving the long-term recovery problems. The is that the national agencies give us a mandate to help people recover to the status they were the day before the disaster happened. That means if you lived in a $4 million house, you'll get help restoring yourself to a $4 million house status. And if you lived under a blackberry bush, you only get help dealing at that, getting back to that level. This is a crazy way for us to be responding. And if you talk to individual people who are working on long-term recovery, they understand this, and they really want to do something about it.
Well, Liza, let me just ask, because Jim Elliott is an expert on FEMA, I just want to get his response to what you're saying. I mean, are there specific sort of, you know, ingrained ideas, policy structures at FEMA that exacerbate this situation, Jim Elliott?
Right. I think the short answer is it's hard to tell for two reasons. One, FEMA, and I agree with Liza, lots of officials are trying to work hard, including those in Washington. But frankly, there are just dozens and dozens of different organizations trying to respond all at once to these disasters, right? And so they're trying to coordinate, whether it's the Department of Housing and Urban Development on their recovery efforts, or the Small Business Administration, or various other agencies, Army Corps of Engineers, et cetera. So it's hard to tell what's going on. And the other part of that that makes it even more difficult is that until these conversations, which are very helpful, I hope, there hasn't even been the question of whether or not we should look at these long-term recovery issues, mm-hmm. because they are complex. And so we're entering a new, hopefully normal in that respect, too, where we scrutinize the rebuilding of the social infrastructure and not just the built infrastructure. And I might just go back to Gabriella's point, too, about how you keep track of this. She talked about lost wages and financial issues, and these things cascade not only over time. So she's talking about initial lost wages, but if you can't afford to pay your rent and you get evicted and you have to lose your security deposit and then dip into any savings you might have, then that begins to cascade through time to sort of generate growing and growing debt in a way that doesn't work. And the other way it cascades is through your social networks and communities. Here in Houston, when we had the big flooding with Harvey in 2017, the best predictor of whether or not you lost wages because of that disaster was if you knew other people who lost wages. And so it becomes a community-wide effect that can really, it's one thing to lose wages, it's another thing to be embedded in a community that's also losing wages, and you're all trying to struggle together to work things out in an environment that Thomas mentioned is very Byzantine. It's difficult to engage the private insurance companies. It's difficult to engage FEMA and the federal apparatuses. And so we need to do a much better job of that over time. And there are two main ways. One is to look at the government and try to change policy there. The other way is through the legislature, that is. The other way is through the courts. And so here in Texas, there's already a federal lawsuit in federal court saying that, you know, this is disproportionate recovery allocation. Everybody pays income taxes that goes to FEMA, but too much aid is going to the homeowners, per Eliza's observation, and not enough to renters post Harvey. And so we need to do a better job of thinking about that equity issue.
Well, you're answering partially this listener's question, what can be done on a policy level to lessen these disparities? Who is doing work right now at the state level that we can support through advocacy? Are there any bills in the works? Before I get to the local and state level support, though, Jim Elliott, I feel like what I'm hearing you say is not only do we have this issue with this Byzantine system, but it sounds like you're saying our disaster recovery efforts are very short-term focused and that we need to start thinking much more long-term now.
Absolutely. And as we think about long term, we have to think about the real disasters that happen after the disaster. The real disasters are how we basically use policy, intentionally or not. I don't think it's intentional, but it plays out to basically weaken our social fabric. We become more unequal over time, and that's not going to help us recover as more and more of these events happen in the future.
Well, Gabriella Orantes, do you know of any state efforts, or have you been working on them at all with your organization that you'd like to highlight for us? And also, if there are any resources for low-income immigrant communities or others who are just getting by that you'd like to mention as well?
Sure. So the North Bay Organizing Project, we have tenant organizers and the housing initiative that have been working diligently over the course of the past couple years to address these issues. And at the state level, I apologize, I don't have the right and specific bills that have been passed recently. But we've definitely been working with coalitions across the state to push our state leaders towards rent control initiatives and tenant protections. Tenant protections is definitely something that is missing that we have advocated for back in 2017 and have continued to only because, like what the previous speaker was saying, a lot of the focus goes to homeowners. And here in Sonoma County, according to, we were at a housing and equity forum put on by Los Cien on March 28th of this year. One of the speakers, Patrick Kellerman, with the Bay Area Council, noted that 28% of homeownership in Sonoma County was 28%, which means the majority of those who live here rent. Without protections, though, during times of disaster, it's just another point that things continue to exacerbate towards the worst for our families. And so that has been a major focus of our long-term recovery strategy of the Just Recovery Partnership, which I wanted to mention that this came about, this Just Recovery Partnership came about after the fires and is supported by the Latino Community Foundation, because there was that intentional vision that there needed to be more than just charity after disasters, but moving towards systemic change. And that's what we're about.
Well, let me go next to Chris in Menlo Park. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how's it going? Hey, to the professor out at Rice University, my mother lives in Houston right now. I was raised there, born and raised there. And I just want to say this. I know she's been through a few floods, and after one flood, she was, just having so much problem with the FEMA situation. She worked through it, but it was just such a horrendous process. I think one of the ways you can find out what the results are is to follow up with individuals who have experienced the FEMA process. And I also believe there's a percentage of folks who wind up having a lien put on their properties and even eventually possibly having their properties taken because of the FEMA money. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I know that there's a lien process in there somewhere, and so it winds up being a loan. Okay, well, and so that's another encumbrance on top of all of the other things that we're talking about. So that's one point. The second point is, I think generally, Katrina gave us a little snapshot about how this works, is that communities themselves have to become resilient outside of the government. And I know that's a tough, thing to try to digest mentally, but this also is reflective of what's happening with schools, with the last comment made about taxes and tax money. Well, it's the same thing happening with schools. And so that it seems like there's a pattern here about how this money is being used and the lack of resiliency, and taking that back really builds up, it even folds into this food desert thing. There's so many elements that are very similar. Well, it comes down to communities not really doing the work themselves.
Well, Chris, let me get some reactions from Jim Elliott, especially on your initial point about FEMA.
Right. No, I appreciate those insights, and I hope your mom's doing okay. On the first point about FEMA recovery, I think it's a great idea to follow up and see how people are experiencing FEMA. Here's part of the difficulty with that. That, under current government guidelines, is considered protected information. And so if you want to go out as a researcher and find out how people are experiencing FEMA individual assistance requests and follow-up, you have to file a Freedom of Information Act to try to get that information. And then when you get it, you don't get a whole lot there. So we need to open up the government a little bit and learn a little bit more about about how we can do exactly the type of follow-up that was mentioned. On the community resilience, I think it's an important point, and there are a number of ways to do it. I'll just say two things. One is, if we have a policy or set of policies, whether it's a combination of insurance premiums and those policies or government policies, all of that recovery effort as a whole is really geared towards restoring property. And if you're a community that has historically been marginalized and not been able to access property and own property to the same extent as other communities, you're now at a deficit. So you want to be resilient. You probably are resilient, probably have been resilient for a long time, but you don't have the financial resources in the same way that other communities that have been historically privileged do. So the community resilience cuts both ways, and we need to think about how to invest in that properly. So one idea is use public infrastructure, use libraries to staff those, especially in underserved communities, to help people navigate the insurance, sort of structure or the FEMA aids, or to share their stories and really invest as a public in helping those communities that might not be as well positioned to get the property sort of development and the property oriented resilience funds.
Gabriela Orontes, one of the things that came up a lot after 2017 was the sense that there needed to be more people at the table, more communities at the table, especially at the level of, county leaders, as well as, generally looking at how the state is reacting to things, that those voices needed to be there. Do you feel like there is a seat at the table for communities that you're working with?
That still needs improvement. So we're getting there. We've been able to have some conversations in the last week, only because the Latino community and leaders of our organizations and individual community leaders have definitely stepped up this time around, learning from 2017. We didn't wait around make sure that things were interpreted or translated, or that Red Cross shelters and other shelters were responsive and culturally sensitive and offering information to monolingual or limited English evacuees. We went and we were there and we interpreted and translated. We didn't wait around for that. That got noticed. And so at this point, we're hoping that, yes, we can get back to the table and work together, take action to have our recommendations. You've spoken previously about the Immigrant Defense Task Force's work, and Irma, an amazing community leader, of many that have gone to our Board of Supervisors to address these very things. We're ready to look and see what areas were acted upon and what areas now need continued follow-up.
And again, Gabriela Orontes is a Just Recovery Fellow for the North Bay Organizing Project. We also have Jim Elliott with us. He's professor and chair of sociology at Rice University and author of Sights Unseen, Uncovering Hidden Hazards in American Cities. And Thomas Fuller, he's San Francisco Bureau Chief for the New York Times. And Thomas Fuller, just one of the things that, you know, all of this reminds us of, and especially the fact that we also have fires in Southern California that we're trying to get under control, is the fact that climate change is just going to make these situations happen probably more frequently and potentially with this degree of intensity. First, can you just tell us, if you happen to know, just what the status is of the fires down south?
Well, I don't know today's developments, but, I think what's striking here is to have north and south at the same time. The firefighters, I was talking to firefighters in Sonoma County who had just driven up from Santa Clarita. And, you know, so they were battling the Tick Fire there, and then they had to, drive 8 hours up to battle the Kincade Fire. I mean, it's really when these fires happen, simultaneously, it's really a strain. And I would like to go to one point that I don't think maybe we've covered in this discussion yet, which is, we've been talking about the fires through a financial lens, and that's very important because, that determines a lot about our lives, our resources. But there's also a psychological strain, a psychic sort of angle to this, which I think is very important, that, when I talk to the people who have potentially benefited from from the rebuilding of their house. They have a brand new house. That's great. They have, you know, it's up to these modern codes. It's filled with new furniture. But I don't think we can discount the loss that everyone experienced, you know, when their house was destroyed. I mean, I talked with a couple in Coffee Park earlier this week, and, you know, they were in their living room in their brand new house. And they looked around. They said, you know, everything in this house is not older than 2 years old because we lost absolutely everything. And so, I mean, I think the financial lens is very important. That's the story I wrote yesterday, and I think it's a great discussion to have. But I think we also need to keep in mind that, you know, the pain of you know, losing everything you own is something that is, you know, felt, if not equally felt, you know, very poignantly across the board.
Yes, and I'm glad you bring that up. And that was the focus of our show just a couple of days ago in terms of the psychological toll of these wildfires, as well as just the physical toll of some of this as well. But then even in that arena, Jim Elliott, we do see just disproportionate effects on people's health and psychology if you are low income, no?
I haven't studied that as closely, but I think there is a rich literature on this. But I want to echo Thomas's point on that. It's very important. As someone who lived through Hurricane Katrina and was in New Orleans when the floodwaters actually hit, I still experience some of the things that he's talking about. Yeah. But I have some of the resources to be able to pick up and move forward, so that helps. So we need to think about both things and how it is that we can help those who don't have that second part, the sort of the financial part of the opportunity. I think, to make this a more equitable future.
Jim Elliott of Rice University, Thomas Fuller of the New York Times, and Gabriel Orantes of the North Bay Organizing Project, thanks to all of you for talking with us this morning and just giving us a sense of the long road ahead. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. We'll have John Lithgow joining us next, so stay with us for that.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.